You're listening to Type Radio. My name is David Crowe. Now we're talking. Type Radio.
Just my type.
We're at the 33 Points Conference in Dortmund, Germany. It's April 4th, 2009, and our guest is David Crowe. Welcome.
Hello.
Are you religious?
No, not really. Not in the conventional sense, I guess. I don't follow an organized religion. I guess I have, like many people, I have sort of a series of beliefs that are personal, but I wouldn't say they were particularly religious. Yeah.
Do you have rituals?
Personal rituals? Yeah, I guess I do have personal rituals. They're just kind of private, silly things, though, really. They're not to do with work. They're more to do with, my wife will like this. When I pile books or things around the house or something, I have to have the big ones at the bottom and the small ones at the top, and I have kind of rituals like that. Like compulsive disorders, perhaps, rather than rituals.
But yeah. Do you need that organization in order to keep a clear head or something?
Yeah, I try to. I'm naturally kind of a bit forgetful, so I have to work quite hard at being organized, particularly, you know, at work. So I keep a close track of my diary, and I like things. I like to know where things are. Yeah, I'm a very kind of organized person. Yeah.
What sort of puzzled us the most is, like, what do you consider yourself to be? Are you a designer? Are you an artist? Are you a researcher? Are you a teacher? Or all in one?
Well, I guess I'll let other people make that decision. What happens to you when you move across from one area to another is you have this period of having to sort of come to terms with where you found yourself and let go of where you come from. And I've been through that a couple of times. So I moved from, you know, I was a designer for about 10 years, and then I moved into education, and I slowly had to come to terms with the idea, when people said to you at parties, what do you do? You would say, oh, I'm a designer. And then you'd realize that actually I get paid to teach. I don't really get paid to design. So you have to gradually let go of one thing and accept a new position. So I moved from being a designer to a teacher, and then I moved from being a teacher to a manager, I guess. So right now, I guess the truth is I'm a professor. I'm an academic manager, mostly, who does some design work to help him to do his job, I guess.
And why did you move from design to teaching?
Well, when I was a designer, I used to struggle also a little with the sort of politics of where I found myself. I worked in the music industry, and I thought that would be an ideal place to work, and it'd be lots of fun, and you'd be out all the time, and you'd be meeting lots of interesting people. And actually, you discover really that you're most of the time, although there are lots of interesting people, most of the time you're packaging up products that you don't really have very much belief in, and you kind of realize it could be chocolate biscuits, really, or it could be bread or something else. It's just another product. And you realize that you're part of some kind of consumption machine. And I was young and idealistic and felt a bit uncomfortable with it, and used to enjoy doing little escapades, little personal projects. And I saw that through part-time teaching that if you were in academia, you could have time and space to do your own things. So you could do design work because you enjoyed it rather than you had to do it. And I thought that that would be a nice compromise, really, that I could kind of teach and bring professional experience but have space to kind of do personal project work. Of course, that gets gradually eroded as you get more responsibilities, and it's hard to keep hold of it.
And do you enjoy being managing?
I think I'm still in that transition where I'm coming to terms with it. It's a funny business education, really. They say, look, you're really good at design, come and teach. And they say, oh, you can teach quite well, why don't you manage? And you realise that you've kind of been moved from area to area without any real logic to that. So I'm just trying to come to terms with the idea that I don't really do much teaching anymore, and I do mostly management. But it can be very rewarding, because you have some kind of sense of being able to help people design experiences for other people that help them in their lives. So it can be very rewarding, but there's a lot of treadmill stuff, you know, a lot of sort of rather dull stuff at times to, you know, it means being part of a big machine to do with finance and all that kind of stuff. And just trying to kind of be involved and stay aware and awake and make sure that decisions are made that are good for your students or for your staff or for art and design. I mean, a university, art and design is a small part, and you often find you fight in the corner for the subject. Yeah.
And do you think it's necessary to be a good designer in order to become a teacher? Or to have that experience?
That's a very good question. I think it helps. I don't think it's necessary. I think you can be a good teacher without being a good designer. It helps not only in your understanding of your subject and thus being able to pass that on, but it brings you a credibility from your audience that is very hard to get otherwise, you know, from either the staff or the students. When you say something, if they have some kind of, I don't know, some kind of like of what you've done in the past, then it'll be a much more credible thing and they'll take it more seriously. You have to work less hard to prove that that really is so.
And does it sort of inspire you in if you do design work yourself, you know, the work that you see from students?
Yeah, working in an art school is like, barely a week goes past where you don't want to be a student again, you know, and that's the great thing about it, because you're bumping into things all the time. Just like you do at a conference like this, you're seeing things all the time that make you want to go back into that workshop and do that, and make you want to spend a bit of time over here in printmaking, and, you know, things inspire you. And having a little bit of, credibility in the school means that if I want to go and learn how to blow glass, somebody will help me to learn how to blow glass. So, I mean, that side of it is fantastic. Yeah, having it's like a toy shop, yeah. Right.
But do the teachers ever do that also?
Some, yeah. But very, not so many of them. They tend to stay in their own area. So the textiles staff will move around inside textiles and they'll do some weave, they'll do some print, they'll do some stitch. But they very rarely come over and say, show me how to do letterpress. And that's the bit I find exciting, going outside of areas that are traditionally graphic design, and then trying to take those, I don't know, those kind of principles that you learned as a graphic designer, take them off into another area and collaborate with somebody who knows how that material works or how this machine works, and find a sort of meeting ground for how you can make something. I find that quite exciting, yeah.
And being in a managing position, does that give you also room to experiment in ways of teaching? Like, can you say, in for this year, maybe we should try it like this, or is that not possible?
That's part of my job, yeah. But you find, well, I find, it's not something you can impose on a team of people. It's with quite a lot of staff. There's about 55 academic staff in my area. And it's not something that's very easily imposed, but I guess it's my job to try and encourage them to try things or to find things themselves. So the one that is my particular favourite is that thing about crossing over from one area to another. So we do mixed projects in the school with students from different areas together. Some of the staff really don't like this because it's hard work and it means they have to rewrite a timetable, or it means that they're suddenly faced with a challenge of a group of students they've never seen before, and the fashion staff suddenly have lots of boys in front of them, and the architects suddenly have lots of girls in front of them, and it there's lots of challenges there. So I guess my job is to encourage them, remind them why they're excited about art school, and usually underneath that excitement is these kinds of ideas, and kind of put a spotlight on those ideas again so that we can have that possibility of mixing things up in the curriculum, yeah. Yeah.
Can you say something about the quality of the students over the years? Has that changed, and in what way has it changed?
Well, I think the quality of student work is still very high. Whether it's changed or not, it's really hard for me to tell. We have ways of measuring quality which are quite kind of pedestrian, really. We have external examiners, we have quality visits. The government come in and they go through your paperwork, and they tend to judge quality on the basis of, you know, did you do what you say you were going to do? In terms of kind of student ideas, though, and inspirational things that they make, lots of academic staff would say that, you know, they're worried about quality because we have twice as many students we used to have, we've got half as many staff we used to have. But actually, when you look at the work, I find it just as exciting as it always was. So the students seem to find a way through it. You know, if they're seeing less of the staff, they'll find another way to do something. They're very adaptable people. And art and design attracts, despite the myth, it does attract very bright people, generally, I'd say. We've got a lot of very clever people who could have done other things but decided to do art and design.
And are you competitive with other art schools?
Yeah, I suppose we are. It's not something we're conscious of all the time, but that's the new world, particularly in the UK. The truth is there's a falling number of young people going into universities, so there's a falling demographic, if you like, of young people. So we will be increasingly looking for the same people. So we'll be fighting for the same students. So we are competitive in that sense. Yeah, but we all have our own character, and I would like to think that we understand each other, and we bring students in, hopefully, who are right for us, who've made a decision that this is the right place to be. And if they're right for us, there's a good chance that they're really not right for that university 20 miles up the road, because that's got a slightly different feel to it. And it's up to them to find that out for themselves, really.
What sparked your interest in typography?
Typography is an area that sort of sucked me in, rather than something I elected to do, really. I was a straight down the line graphic designer, really, in a design group in London, and the guy who ran that, a guy called Malcolm Garrett, was you know, a very good typographer, a very keen typographer. So I suppose that helped. But I was asked to do things for typography conferences, or Fuse magazine used to ask me to do things, and suddenly I got kind of invited into this typographic world as some kind of wild card of. You know, I'm not a type designer like Martin, who was in today, Martin Muir. It's not really my world. So the typography kind of adopted me somehow. I don't really know how or why. And sometimes feel like something of a fraud, actually, that to be in an arena like this. So I always find myself talking about things kind of on the fringes of typography, and I'm not talking about metrics and detail and aligning figures or non-aligning, I don't talk about that kind of detail.
So how did you make the jump to semiotics and symbols and
that? That was through teaching. That was through, at that time I was teaching in Liverpool, and we had like most courses, we had this kind of cultural theory program that underpinned the practical work. And it felt bolted on. It didn't feel integrated in somehow. And the students tended to kind of not take it very seriously because it was taught by a different team of staff. All the books were in a different part of the library. There was no pictures in them. Some of the staff, I think it's fair to say, that taught those subjects kind of liked to make it sound difficult, and theory was hard. And I thought that actually theory really wasn't that difficult. It was just a question of connecting it up to the pictures. So the jump to semiotics was to show the students how the two things could connect up quite seamlessly, really, that they could be integrated together, and they could be proud of their subject, that there was something that underpinned their subject that they could talk to people about, we ask our students to write around their subject. And it gave them a place to start thinking about how they might write around their subject.
But is that also the time that you started writing about it yourself?
Yeah. I would write it down to do a lecture. It's kind of just circumstance, really. Somebody would invite me to do a talk at something like this. I'd talk about it. Some students would come up afterwards and say, well, that was really useful. Have you published something? And slowly I realised that I ought to really publish something. So it was aimed very much at them. It was aimed at a student audience, that first book, and was designed to be aimed at a student audience, to be kind of friendly and homely and kind of soft and easy to use and full of pull quotes and things like that. Apparently it's, you know...
Is it part of the recommended reading?
It is in a few places, yeah. It's very nice to see, actually, yeah. It's silly. It's kind of odd, really. You go to the occasional university and somebody will come up and say, oh, would you write your name in my book? Or something. It's just really nice. It's not why I did it, obviously, but it's, yeah, it makes you feel good. As I said, it can be a rewarding career, yeah.
And have you revised it since?
No, I ought to actually, because the pictures are starting to get a little out of date, the images. It'd be quite good to go back to the first one and update it with new imagery that is perhaps nearer to the stuff that the students have been looking at more recently, because it's probably sort of 5 years old now, yeah.
Do you feel, coming from Manchester, do you feel connected to other Manchester designers, Canadian designers like Peter Saville, for instance? Mm-hmm. Oh, because you also worked in the record industry. And
yeah, I suppose so. I'm Scottish, actually. I'm not from Manchester. And I went to Manchester because...
At what age?
19, something like that, 20. And I think I was working for an architect. I was an architectural technician. And I was working for an architect and wanted to go to art school, and had to tell little kind of white lies to get away for interviews for art school. And the first one was Manchester, and they accepted me, so I went to Manchester. And I didn't realise until I was there that there was a bit of a kind of history around Manchester, and there was Factory Records, there was Malcolm Garrett and the Buzzcocks and all that kind of music scene, and then there was Peter and Joy Division. And while I was a first-year student there, the Hacienda opened. And I guess, that's all part of me now. It's part of the aesthetic, that whole kind of industrial aesthetic is very, very Mancunian. Yeah, so I do feel connected to it, yeah. And I do enjoy it, yeah.
And we talked about it a little bit yesterday, going into detail. Can you pinpoint what is specifically Mancunian in graphic, not your work, but in graphic design?
Well, as I said, I think there's a bit of an industrial aesthetic to some of the work. I mean, it'd be a generalisation, because you'll have lots of people writing in now who'll say, what about him and what about her? But generally, you're Peter and Malcolm, that generation anyway, and maybe Trevor Johnson. They had an enjoyment of industrial kind of graphics, and I mean, Manchester was where the Industrial Revolution started. It's an industrial Victorian city, and it has that kind of feel of kind of heavy engineering to it, and I think somehow that comes over in those quite kind of quite aggressive and quite tough kind of graphic approach to stuff that sort of stuff that Joy Division would have done, or Factory Records was built around that aesthetic, really.
And you were also mentioned yesterday about finding Britishness, or what is British?
Well, that's really hard, isn't it? Well, as I said yesterday, our Prime Minister seems to be obsessed with this at the minute, what is Britishness? And it's a wee bit worrying, really.
Why is that?
Well, why is he obsessed with it? Why is it worrying? Why is he obsessed with it? I think it's a political move, actually. He has a Conservative Party who are gaining ground on him daily. He has a general election coming up like a fast-moving train. And he knows that the Conservative Party are managing to kind of... to present themselves as the voice of Britain. And he knows he needs to steal some of that ground. I think it's that cynical. And I was watching that G20 summit and quite interested in how they were going to present it, because that must be very much what he's trying to do. He's trying to show Britain as the centre of the solution and be British. And it came down to Gil Sands. Centred Gil Sands was Britain. So as I said yesterday, I guess there's these sort of typographic histories and visual histories that we would draw on if we wanted to sort of quantify Britishness, but I think it's just a convention, really. I think it's got to be more of a, if there is a Britishness, it's probably more of a kind of mixed up attitude towards how you do things, and hopefully it's open and multicultural like Britain is, and it's not just about letter spaced Gil Sands and crowns and heraldry, which are the things that you would, you know, if you walk down Savile Row, you see things like the Huntsman shop, and it's beautiful. You know, it has kind of gold Gil Sands letter spaced across the window, and you think just how British that is. But in a sense, there's a sort of politic in that, isn't there, about British Empire, and I don't know how it feels to be black and from Brixton and walk down Savile Row and see that, and how it makes them feel, because it's not very inclusive.
No, they're probably not even connected to that.
No.
What is your personal escapade?
Personal escapade. That's like the first question. Do I believe in religion? Am I religious? I don't know. I read this book recently that said that you have to have a belief. It doesn't have to be religious, but you have to have kind of something that you kind of use as a guiding principle. And I suppose it's just that when you go, for me, it's when you're gone, whatever you've left behind and whatever you've done while you were here will make the place a bit more interesting than it was if you weren't here. I think it's that simple, really. Try and do things without harming people and try and make it interesting. Kind of basic principle of life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time Radio FM. Now we're talking.